Hi everybody, is everybody doing okay? Apart from, you know, minor surgery and things. Any new report? You feel better? No, you weren't sick, you were just away.
Yeah.
Are you back? I guess I can tell you're back. I got a new phone.
I got a new phone too.
Did you really?
Yeah.
What does it look like?
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah, it's very slick. Mine doesn't look like, I'm gonna put mine away now because it's not charged. My other one, as far as I know, is still in Hoboken. Any news to report? Any exciting developments? Any stuff you heard in the news that you wonder, what is that? Keep thinking. See, when I look at the news and there's stuff about computers, I think, oh, I bet people who don't know computers are really curious about this and would love to hear from a computer expert about what's really going on. That doesn't seem to be true. But I ask anyway, because, you know, hope springs eternal. All right, so what I'd like to do today is talk about chapter 7 in the book, but I will lead off, as almost always, with some clicker questions. Whoops. All right. First, a couple questions about the lecture from last time. First question, which problem, I was talking about parallel processing, and these are all various things you can think of from a parallel processing standpoint. Which of these problems did I not discuss in class? Fence painting, novel writing, web searching, visual processing, and number summing. I talked about all these except for one of them. Almost everybody. One more. 3, 2, 1. There it is. Thank you. All right. So I did talk about fence painting, where the idea was if you want to have a very long fence and you want to paint it fast and you've got lots of people, you assign each person a segment of fence as opposed to assigning each person one little tiny part of the job, like opening the paint cans for one person and cleaning the brushes for another person. I talked about novel writing as something that is actually very hard to make into a parallel system, try to speed up using parallel processing, because everything is so interdependent that you really need one person's brain to kind of see the whole thing and map it out. You know, that being said, things like large-scale video games or movies do involve lots and lots of people working in parallel. If one person had to make, say, any movie, Star Wars or something like that, it would be taking forever. So they really do get an advantage out of having multiple people working on it. Web search, I definitely talked about. In fact, I called the lecture Google 3. The idea that if you have lots of people who are searching over the same data, you could actually have lots of computers basically doing exactly the same thing at the same time. Because when I'm querying Google and you're querying Google at the same time, we're not coordinating in any way. So our two separate computers can handle our requests and get the results back. Visual processing turns out to be a really important application of parallel processing. Biologically, anyway, we have tons and tons of independent neurons that are all working together to analyze what we're seeing. And some people have tried to take advantage of that some people working for Hillis, in fact, to try to make that work faster on a computer. But I didn't talk about it. Whereas summing a bunch of numbers, we actually did a demo at the end where everybody had their own number and we started, and half the class had the sum of two numbers each, and then a quarter of the class had the sum of four numbers each, until we actually got the sum of everything. So the right answer should be D. I very briefly mentioned the novel writing. Talked about J.K. Rowling. All right, next question. Answers were too long.
It's a question in the audience.
Good, hello.
Hi. I got the right answer for visual processing. Isn't that the same thing as computers? I mean, video games?
No, so the idea of visual processing is you have a camera connected to a computer, and or anything that is looking out into the world, like an eyeball, connected to, looking out at the world, and then something has to process the information that comes in, the visual information, the image information. And so visual processing in, for computer science ends up being things like recognizing, writing programs that recognize people's faces, or some companies use these in factories to see if there's any flaws in the product that they're creating. They'll have a camera looking at the end of the assembly line to try to spot, you know, broken Xboxes as they come off the assembly line, that sort of thing. So this idea of processing visual information.
How does that differ from the other thing you said?
You said there
are drawing
parallel systems where, like in a video game, like a level, they're working on like the scenery at the same time they're working on the streets and all that.
Well, they're often related. They're often considered to be related because usually some of the conferences actually deal with both vision and what I would call graphics, what you're talking about. One is basically input, where the computer is taking in visual information about the real world. And the other one, the computer knows what the world is. It's inside the computer, but it wants to display it back out at you so you can see it. So the visual processing then happens in the person, right? We're talking about a video game. And in the person, it really is happening in parallel, right? We do have lots and lots of our brain that simultaneously is working on figuring out what's in there. So I guess maybe what your point is, I did mention computer graphics, which is really closely related to visual processing, but I had not known I mentioned that. So there you go. All right, next question. Is solving a problem with N computers, is solving a problem with N computers N times faster than solving it with one? So you've got a big problem, you want it to get solved, you've got N computers, we'd like each one to do a little piece of that problem so the whole thing gets solved N times faster. Does that really work? Yes, each one can do some of the work. No, because each computer will have to be n times slower. Yes or no, depends on how the problem is structured. Yes, but only if n is very big. Yes, but only if n is 1. In other words, no.
Seconds, 3, 2, 1, stopping.
All right, so if you think about the examples that I just gave on the last question, it's not the case, for example, in a novel, it's not the case that you can just get a whole lot of different processes or different workers to solve some piece of the task and it'll get done n times faster. That's not always the case. But there is some cases where it is. When you have n different computers at Google handling lots and lots of people's queries, it does get done n times faster because each one is actually busy all the time doing the work that needs to get done. So really, it ends up being yes or no depending on how the problem is structured. When n is big, actually, that makes it harder to take advantage of parallelism. So D is definitely out, and E is really just a synonym for
B, more or less. Oh, good. Either that or we're just all very wishy-washy, right? It's the only question that doesn't give a definitive answer. Okay, we don't like definitive answers. The corresponding chapter in the book,
Danny Hillis talked about his own experience designing and building and justifying creating a parallel computer. His parallel computer had how many processors? About 5, about 500, about 50,000, about 5 million, or about 500 million.
He actually built and sold this computer for a number of years.
I think by the time the book was written, he was done with that company, and he was working at a different company. Does anybody know where he worked after he went? He left Thinking Machines, the company he founded? He kind of went from a company where he created the whole thing to an enormous company that pre-existed for, you know, 50 years, maybe more. He actually went to Disney and became an Imagineer, which is a lot like a Mouseketeer, except geekier, if you could imagine. All right, the answer, does anyone remember the exact number? I did mention it, it was in the book too. All right, let's see if anybody remembered the approximate number. Yeah, very good. Okay, so
I think you probably have a better idea than you're letting on. What was the number? Or did you just get 50,000 because it was in the middle? It worked this time. Anybody remember? I'll give you a hint, it's a power of 2. What's the power of 2 that's closest to 50,000?
It's quoted in the book as 64,000, but that's not a power of 2. I would have taken 64,000. The number is 2 squared 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 squared, or 65,536.
Just saying. All right, now the chapter for today is chapter 8 of it? And this is one of the central questions in that chapter is, can computers learn from experience?
So is it yes, or no, they can only do what they're programmed to do, they can't actually learn new stuff from experience. No, because they're not alive, they're just machines. No, because of the halting problem, it says computers can't solve all problems. No, because they don't know what their goal is. So how can they learn to get better at their goal if they don't actually know what their goal is?
Say hi. Okay. 5 more seconds. 4, 3, 2, 1, and stop it. Yes, that's what this chapter is about. It sort of doesn't make sense to have a chapter about computers learning if they can't learn. So of course B is true in a sense, right? They can only do what they really can only do what they're programmed to do. But if they're programmed to learn, then the answer really isn't no, it's actually yes. And it turns out you actually have to think about programming a little bit differently to get the computer to actually gain experience and learn from that experience. You have to have a program whose behavior can actually change depending on what new inputs come in. So it's an interesting, it turns out to be an interesting topic, at least to me. This is the area that I do my research in. All right, in the chapter about learning, he actually, to kind of motivate learning and to give you a sense of how a computer system or a machine might be able to learn, he talks more generally about feedback systems that sense the environment and from that information from the environment change their behavior, sometimes in very fixed static ways and sometimes in adaptive ways depending on what the outcomes are. He mentioned 4 out of the 5 of these, a thermostat. So these are all feedback systems, but he didn't mention one of them. A thermostat, it's got a target temperature, so it has a goal, right? Its goal, it is happy when the temperature is in the range that it's set to be happy in. If the temperature goes too far down, if it's too cold, then what does the thermostat do? It tells the furnace to turn on, circulate hot air, and with the hope that it doesn't really have hope, but with the design that the temperature will rise and enter the goal target, the goal region again. If on the other hand the temperature goes outside the goal region on the high side, so the temperature gets too high, depending on whether your house supports this or not, what does it do? A sad dance, it sweats. What's that? It certainly should turn off the heat, right? If it's gotten too hot, it should turn off the heat. But how? What does it do to try to bring the temperature back into range? What? It can turn on the air conditioning if you have air conditioning.
Autopilot is another interesting thing. These are systems that are built into airplanes that actually help the airplane keep its heading. And why is that a hard problem? Because you can point the airplane in a direction, but 5 minutes later, because of air turbulence and so forth, it may have actually bumped off, and now what is now straight used to be the wrong direction, and so it actually needs to now turn itself back onto target. And so it's just like a thermostat in a sense, right? It's got left and right instead of hot and cold. If it's too far to the left, it needs to turn a little bit to the right. If it's too far to the right, it needs to turn a little bit to the left. What makes autopilots a little harder to set up, say, than a thermostat is, for one thing, hundreds of people don't die if the thermostat goofs. So that's relevant, right? Another thing is that there's a delay between taking an action on an airplane loose, twiddling one of the flaps and so forth, and actually seeing the airplane change positions. There can be quite a substantial delay. And if it may overturn, which would be a problem. Right? There's all sorts of things that can go wrong. I don't know much about airplanes. But if you've ever taken an airplane, you can see why this is important. A guy named Patrick Winston at MIT wrote a program to get better and better at identifying blocks arranged as an arch. And the way that it did that is it was given a description of how the blocks were arranged relative to one another, and then a person would say, that's not an arch. And then we'd be shown another organization of blocks, and a person would say, that is an arch. And after a couple examples like this, the system would begin to generalize. It would make a prediction as to whether something is an arch or not, and if it was wrong, the person gave it feedback saying that it was wrong, it would change its behavior so it would give different answers in the future. That's an example of a learning program. Jerry Cesaro at IBM wrote a program for learning to play backgammon. Backgammon is the board game. It actually learns to play better and better over time, till it actually was beating all but the very best human experts. And in fact, it was playing slightly differently than the best human experts. So they learned what the backgammon player was doing, the program was doing, and learned to improve their play by watching the learning program. So it's sort of a neat story of the feedback between people and peers. And the perceptron was a learning algorithm that it's similar to the ARCH program in that it takes vectors of numbers and makes a prediction as to whether an example is a positive example or a negative example. We're going to see more of this today. And if it's wrong, then it adjusts its weight so that it's more likely to give the right answer in the future. So these are all feedback systems. One of these Hillis didn't actually mention. Stopping. All right, whoa. I'm pretty sure that Tesoro's work actually took place after the book was published. But it's also not, I mean, the reason that, I'd never heard of this ARCH program before, and Hillis talks about it like it was one of the great breakthroughs in machine learning. Part of the reason for this, and I'm hoping that nobody from this school is actually downloading the podcast, is that Winston was a professor at MIT, Hillis was a student, and then a grad student at MIT. And MIT people really see the world as consisting of MIT and then like the barbarians. And so anything that happens at MIT is great and important, and things that happen outside of MIT are less important. All right, almost uniform. A little bit higher on the autopilot. He talks a lot about the autopilot. Alrighty. The answer was Tesoro's backgammon program, which was D. All right, now what I'd like to do is try to get through this material pretty fast. There's not, I'm not planning to ask any questions on this on the final. Please don't run away. All right, what I'd like to do is get through this material because it's kind of neat. A lot of people have got very inspired. When neural nets first started to become popular, lots of researchers said, this is awesome, this is everything. They all switched their research very briefly to this area, and then they did what they had to do, and then they got out and went back to whatever they were doing before. So it does have this kind of faddy, exciting feel to it, so I'd like to tell you about it. But also, at the end of the lecture, what I'd like to do is a demo where we'll actually try to solve a learning problem as a group where you guys are the data. We'll see how that works out.
You can see why I want to rush through it. All right, so
you know, usually we think about a program as being something written by an experienced person. I, as a human being, know what I want the program, the computer, to do, and so I put in the right instructions so that when the computer runs the program, it does what I wanted it to do. And that's, in fact, most of what programming is about, most about what, but there are cases where the program, a human being creates the program, but the program's not really finished yet. The program actually needs to have gathered some of its own experience because before it can actually solve the problem that it's programmed to solve. And one concrete example of this is when we talked about compression. We talked about trying to take a sequence of characters and encode them in a small number of bits, as small as we could, by taking advantage of the fact that some characters were very common and giving them short codes, and some characters were very long and giving them long codes, or not, sorry, some characters were very rare and giving them long codes. Otherwise, it's a tautology. And that the program that did that encoding needed an example first to find out which characters were the common ones and which ones are the rare ones. So really, when I wrote the program, I had no idea ultimately what kind of code it would produce. I just let it learn that. I let it figure it out from its own experience of gathering characters and data. And so most compression programs that you run, whether you use zip or whatever on your computer to get files in and out that are smaller than what they would take to do otherwise, all have this adaptive kind of learning component to it. The compression program itself develops its code based on the kinds of character patterns that it actually sees in the data. So this is a very kind of simplistic example of how a program can actually change its behavior and learn based on experience. I mean, you might not want to call it that, but it's really hard to draw the line between something like this and something like a person learning to do things, other than the fact that we're much better at it than compression programs. So there's a field. Maybe it used to be called statistics, but now we've got better words for things, and we call it machine learning. The idea of writing programs that actually use data or experience to create better programs than people can write directly. If I knew exactly what I wanted it to do and I could just say that, I would do it. But there's lots of cases where I, as a programmer, don't have the whole story, and the computer is going to have to gather its own experience before it can actually do the best job of solving the problem. Now, it turns out there's lots of sub-cases of what machine learning can be. The area of machine learning that I work in is mostly reinforcement learning, which is about programs learning to carry out sequences of tasks, sequences of behaviors to accomplish a goal. But it's sort of complicated, and it's not as far along as another area, and it wasn't mentioned in the book. So I'm going to focus on supervised learning, which is a different kind of machine learning that's a bit better understood. And so this specific problem is about taking experience in the form of labeled examples, and what the learning system needs to do is learn to label novel examples. So let me give some examples of this to you so you have some idea of what it is I'm talking about. Before I do that, this particular task actually goes by very many different names that are all slightly different but really very closely related. Classification learning, statistical learning, data mining, sometimes you hear it, it's a very flashy word for this. Concept learning, discriminative learning, which sounds like it could be bad, but they don't mean it like that. Logistic regression and pattern recognition. These are all different names people have used over time to refer to the same kinds of concepts. So let me give you the basic idea. So in its simplest form, one of these learners, a supervised learner, its job is to create a classifier. A classifier is something that takes examples, take objects as input, and then assigns each one to a class or a label. And in the simplest case, objects are all represented as vectors of features. So it's just a list of numbers of a fixed length. And the classes are just plus and minus, true and false, 0, 1. So just one distinction that you're trying to learn to make. So this morning when I woke up, I got an email from somebody in my group who saw this particular article. And thought it was really funny with respect to his own research, but it was really perfect for this lecture, so I just slotted it in right away. So this is Slashdot. Do people know what Slashdot is? Anybody know what Slashdot is? So Slashdot, yeah. So Slashdot is the, what is it like to normal people?
It's news for nerds.
News for, is that what it says?
Stuff that matters.
News for nerds, stuff that matters. So, but it's more than just news, right? It's
the place that the really into nerdy people go, they all go there, they all get this information. There's a thing called the Slashdot effect, which is basically if you get mentioned on the Slashdot homepage, your website is going to be inundated with geeks from all over the world, and they have a tendency to actually crash your computer, not out of maliciousness, but just because they're all curious about the same thing at the same time, because it appeared in Slashdot. So anyway, this appeared in Slashdot, I guess, early this morning. And here's the article.
So this is a lot. Oh wait, can I actually get this? I think I have to click over and get it off the web.
Careful, it's uncensored.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
But the article, you mean the comments?
The comments. Are
all right, but I won't read that. I won't do the comments. I'll just read the article. I just read Slashdot for the articles.
So Richard Burke, a University of Pennsylvania criminologist, somebody who studies criminal behavior, has worked with authorities, I'm going to guess that means police, to develop a software tool that predicts who will commit homicide, who's going to kill. So as a classification problem, now we're talking about people as the input, and the output is just yes or no, are you a killer or are you not a killer? Cannot find any papers published on this topic by Burke nor any sites stating what specific algorithm he uses, but the article that this person is citing goes like this. The tool works by plugging 30 to 40 variables into a computerized checklist. Now, by variables, it just means that each person that they want to find out about is represented by a set of 40 numbers. One of them might be age. Another one might be what state was this person born in? What was the socioeconomic status of this person's parents? Male or female, right? You can just think about, easily come up with 30 or 40 discriminative variables, right? Variables that you could measure about different people. So it takes 30 or 40 variables, puts them in a computerized checklist, and starts off with a whole bunch of examples. These examples say, here's a person that we know about, and here's whether or not that person was a killer. Here's another person we know about, represented by these 40 variables, and whether or not that person was a killer. We start off with a list of thousands of people, maybe tens of thousands of people. All right, you can imagine, which in turn produces a score associated with future lethality. Lethality being deadliness, right? Killingness. You can imagine the indicators that might incline someone towards violence. Youth? Being young, I guess, inclines one towards violence. But not you guys, obviously. You're young, right? I'm scared now. Having committed a serious crime at an early age, being a man rather than a woman, and so on. You can imagine 40 of these variables, some of which will have some predictive value about criminality. Each by itself probably isn't going to make a person pull the trigger, be a killer. But put them all together and you've got a perfect storm of forces for violence, Burke said. Asked which, if any, indicators stood out as reliable predictors of homicide, Burke pointed to one in particular, youthful exposure to violence. And I'm hoping that this doesn't mean like video games. I think what this really means is, you know, seeing someone get killed or having someone in your family get killed. It's really serious stuff, not just like TV cartoon stuff. The software is to enter clinical trials next spring in the Philadelphia Probation Department. Its intent is to serve as a kind of triage to let probation caseworkers concentrate most of their effort on the former offenders most likely to be most dangerous. So you can sort of see why this is creepy, possibly useful, and maybe even interesting from an intellectual standpoint of just trying to figure out how you would actually build a system that would be able to classify people into killers and not killers. Yeah?
Have you seen the movie Minority Report?
It reminded me of that, right? So I did not see the movie, but I saw enough of the promos. This is like Tom Cruise, like pre-crazy outburst Tom Cruise, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, where he was, this is a in a future where they have, were there psychics or they just had special computers?
They have like these weird psychics that...
Okay. They could predict that someone was going to commit a crime, which is kind of like this, right? Predicting future criminal activity. Now, if they took the output of this program and used it to arrest people, I think we would all be up in arms about that. It's like, well, the computer's fallible. Even if it weren't fallible, it's still predicting that someone's going to commit violence and actually committing violence seem like two different things. So you can see why this could lead one to creepy thoughts. But I don't know. I was just amazed that someone had gone this far and actually worked out the details of how this would work. Any other questions about that? I use this as an actual concrete example of the problem of classification, and presumably they actually used some kind of one of the algorithms we're going to talk about today to do it. I had come up with an example before that, which I don't think is nearly as societally relevant. I don't know, maybe it is, but it's not quite scary anyway.
Imagine instead of figuring out whether or not someone's going to be a killer, try to predict whether or not someone's going to make it through college, drop out or not of college. So the input now, an example, is a high school student, and the output is just yes or no, do we think this person's going to make it all the way through college? The person's going to be represented as a vector of features. Just like in the criminal case, the variables that we can choose, and we could probably make up some that would be relevant. Score on the SATs, grade in math, English, science, whether or not the person's a killer, according to the other program, age, parents' income, years of current address, height, I don't know, who knows? You can just imagine throwing in a whole bunch of these variables that try to provide a blurry picture of what this person might be like, and then what we'd like is a classifier that would take that blurry picture and then use it to make a prediction about whether or not the person will make it through. If it was any good, it could be useful as a tool for admissions or maybe financial aid or, I don't know, future employers. Who knows what it could be good for? In fact, again, this also might be considered slightly creepy. All right, so that's a classifier. A classifier solves a particular problem. It takes a vector of features in as input and produces a yes-no response. What we're now going to talk about is the learning problem, which takes examples as input and produces a classifier as output, right? So it's going to go through some data, try to figure out the best way of classifying individuals, and then its output is going to be a little program that when you run it, classifies individuals, yes or no. So in particular, its input is going to be a training set. A training set is labeled instances. Each instance is a feature vector. So here's somebody this is a picture of someone as a high school student. And then this is whether or not that person made that out of college, yes or no. Here's another high school student as a vector of numbers, and here's whether or not that person made it out of college. Imagine thousands of examples like this. You can start to get a good statistical handle on which kinds of people are going to make it through and which ones aren't. So that's what the input is. The output is going to be now the classifier that actually figures out how to take a new feature vector and predict whether or not that person's going to make it through. When we talk about a learning algorithm, we're talking about a program that actually addresses this problem. It's a learning program in that, ultimately, its behavior is whatever the classifier does, but the programmer doesn't create the classifier. The combination of what the programmer says and the data make the classifier.
So it's kind of a collaboration. So here's a slightly more whimsical and easier to deal with example.
Just to be concrete, My mom told me, never wear white shoes after Labor Day. And I'm not sure why, because she never actually really told me this. Mostly what she did is if I picked out white shoes and wore them after Labor Day, she would belittle me until I changed my shoes. This actually was her mode with a lot of different topics, but let's just focus on the shoes for the moment. So here's what we got. We've got a bunch of examples, dates in terms of month and day, and whether or not my mom said it was okay to wear white shoes on that day. So we have a couple examples where the answer was yes, it was okay. You know, August 30th, my birthday, July 4th, September 4th, September. But after September 4th, September 5th, it was no longer okay. Now the label is a zero. October 31st, Halloween, no. Christmas, no. Like that. Okay. Now, we're imagining that the rule is actually starting in January, it's okay up until Labor Day, and then from Labor Day till the end of the year, it's not okay. In fact, I think it has something to do with maybe Memorial Day and Labor Day, but let's keep it really simple for the time being. All right, so now what we'd like to do is, given these examples, we'd now like to predict for October 9th, is it okay to wear white shoes? For March 30th, is it okay to wear white shoes? And in some sense, if this is all we're given as input, if we're not told the rule, if we're just given examples, it really could be any. Like the rule could be something like, it's white shoes after Labor Day except March 30th, right? I mean, there could be crazy exceptions. There's no way to say that there's going to be one right answer to this. But some answers are simpler than others, and they fit the data better, and so those are maybe the more reasonable answers. So that's what we're going to try to do now, is figure out how to label the new examples based on our experience, based on the previously labeled examples. Is everybody okay with this? Is anyone not clear on what the task is? Can anybody tell me what should go here? This one should be what, based on the examples? This should be a 0, and this one should be a 1. Does that make sense? If nothing else, you can sort of see this one is falling in between these two, and that they're ones, and this one seems to be falling maybe in between these two, and they're both zeros. And so, that seems like a pretty reasonable guess, unless the world is crazy.
So in fact,
because this problem isn't really well defined, like doing well on unobserved examples, there's no way. I can always make up an example where you're just going to get the wrong answer. So we can't really make that the official problem. So instead, we're going to say, let's find of all the classifiers of a given complexity or with as few exceptions as possible, we want to make the minimum number of mistakes on the training set. Now we have to actually be a little bit careful here because we want to avoid what's called overfitting.
The idea of overfitting says, hey, here's a rule that works perfectly on the training set.
I'm going to say that the answer for 214, 74, 830, and 94 is 1, and everything else is 0. That fits the data perfectly, but it has too many exceptions in it, and it's actually very unlikely to generalize well, because when new examples come in, all it's going to do is check if in the training set it was already a 1, and then say 1. It's not going to generalize really around those examples at all.
So there's a whole field, there's a whole at least subfield that tries to deal with this issue of how much generalization can you do? How much can you infer from the examples? But let's not worry about that at the moment. All right, so if that's the problem is we're given a bunch of examples that are labeled, and then a couple examples that are not labeled, and we want to guess their labels as accurately as possible. What algorithms do we have to do that? Well, it turns out there's a whole bunch. We've got, I'm hoping to do a demo with decision trees at the end of the class, but that's not really one of the more popular algorithms right now. Boosting is very popular. It's developed by a guy who's now a professor at Princeton. Nearest neighbors is a really simple thing that probably if you thought about this problem for 10, 15 minutes, you'd probably come up with something like this, which just says, if you have an example that you don't know the label for, look through the data and find the one that's closest to it, that's most similar to it, and then just use whatever label it has. Right? That's a very reasonable way to do things. In fact, sometimes I think when I look at some of the exam answers, I think that's exactly what people are doing. Right? They're saying, this is the answer that I saw that was most similar to, or this is the question that I've seen that I know the answer to, that this is most similar to, I'll just use that answer. And it often works. It just doesn't always work. Support vector machines are also very popular, also developed. I mean, these are probably the two most popular machine learning algorithms, both developed by people that live in New Jersey. I'm just saying. Neural networks I'm going to talk more about today. Naive-based classifiers are really powerful, especially if you have lots and lots and lots of data. The Google people love these because they've got more data than anybody else in the universe, as far as we know. But there's lots of other algorithms that can do this. But they all try to solve the same problem of given the examples with the labels, try to guess labels for the examples that aren't labeled. All right, but neural nets are kind of sexy in a way. So I want to, exciting and science fiction-y sounding, right? And you'll see in stories, in fiction, people will talk about these things as if, brains are neural networks, right? They've got neurons. Therefore, right? Computers are smart. I'm not quite believing that. But anyway, so that I figured it's a fun thing to talk about. And we'll talk about a really simple part of it that's actually quite useful. So the idea of a neural network is inspired by brains, but if you actually talk to real neuroscientists, they think this is laughable, right? Because it really has very little to do with brains. It's like arithmetic. It's like brains, because brains do arithmetic. But ultimately, it's actually just a simple and flexible mathematical representation. So this is, here's a microscope slide of some neurons. These are brain cells, right? Brain cells, each one connects from some other brain cells and connects to other brain cells, and they fire, they spike, they send off electrical signals. Once they've gathered enough charge from the neurons that talk to them, they get excited, and then they fire and send off a charge to everybody that they're connected to. They're kind of like telephone networks, except instead of sending, voice signals to each other, they're just sending psh, psh, almost like zeros and ones. They're sending these little spike signals. They're sending electrical pulses. So this is your classic neural net picture. It goes something like this. We imagine that we've got whatever our input is to the net that it's using to decide what's going on, it's all encoded as a series of numbers. Each of these circles has a number in it. Then each of those circles are connected by these weighted edges. This is a graph, right? This is a directed graph. To a hidden layer, which are more neurons. Then the hidden layer neurons all send off information to the output neuron, which ultimately is going to spit out a 0 or a 1. Now what these neurons are doing is they're actually taking a weighted sum of the activity level, of the numbers that are in these other circles, and if that weighted sum goes above a certain threshold, then they send off
a value of essentially one down the wire to whatever's downstream of them. They end up being like almost like little AND and OR gates.
But they're more general. They handle more general numbers than just zeros and ones.
So the pieces of this are, there's the feature vector. Each component of the feature vector becomes an input unit. Usually we'll throw in an extra input unit that always has an input of 1. Turns out it makes some of the math easier. Each input unit is connected to a sum unit with a weight. The input value is multiplied by the weight, and they're all summed together. If the sum is greater than 0, then the output is 1, else 0. Though sometimes you can actually get it to just scale the numbers instead of a threshold, like 0, 1 threshold. It's just some kind of transformed value of whatever the sum is.
And there's a zillion different ways to do that. But let me give you a
concrete example of this that solves specifically the when can you wear white problem. So it's going to go like this. This is the neural net. It's got three input units, one for the month. That's one of the features, one of the variables. One for the day, and one that's always one. Then it's connected by these, they're supposed to be like axons from neurons. They're just a weighted edge. That's going to take whatever the value is in this node, multiply it by minus 30 in this case, and send it off to this summing unit. That happens, all three of these units send their weighted the weighted value to the sum unit. They all get added up. And then if it's bigger than 0, this unit ends up having a value of 1, otherwise it's a value of 0. So it's like a neuron, and it spikes if the activity level is positive. In other words, it just stays quiet. So let's look what this particular network does on the two examples that we needed to label. So the first one, the month is October 10, the day is 9, and the 1 is 1. And what we're going to now do is take the first value, multiply it by the weight on that edge, and send it off to the sum. So we get minus 30 times the 10, which is the input value, to get minus 300. The second edge, the value is 9. We multiply it by the weight of minus 1. That gives minus 9 for that contribution for that unit. And the 1 has a value of 1, which we multiply by the weight and get 275. Then we take those three numbers and sum them up, minus 300 plus minus 9 plus 275, and that gets us minus 34. And since that's negative, less than 0, then this output is 0. So this classifier actually spits out for October 9th the answer of 0. Okay? With me? Questions about that? We'll plug, in case you didn't catch it the first time, we'll plug it through again. The second input is March 30th, 330, and then the 1 is still the 1. We multiply the 3 by minus 30, get minus 90. We multiply the 30 times minus 1, get minus 30. 275 by 1 is 275. Add them all up, get 155, which is positive, greater than 1, so the output is 1. So this classifier classifies March 30th as being okay for wearing white shoes, and October 9th as not okay for wearing white shoes. Now, it turns out that I very carefully chose the weights on these units so that this would work. Okay? But this is a correct classifier. This classifier works for any calendar day in the year for correctly predicting whether it's before or after Labor Day. Yeah?
What's the 275?
So the 275 is the weight on this edge. And in particular, this is a weight from a unit that always has the value of 1. If we didn't have this, it turns out we couldn't solve this particular problem. It just lets us kind of rescale the values one way or the other. So what this does is it means that the sum here is always going to be 275 higher than it would have been if we left this whole thing out. And that's important because if once we add the 275, that takes it over 0, then it's a positive example, otherwise it's a negative example.
I'm saying 275 is supposed to be 275 out of the days out of the year, I guess?
No, it's just a number. It's a number. I went through and guessed what the weights on these edges would be, and then I tried a bunch of examples, and when it didn't work, I oogied the numbers. I just kind of goofed around with the numbers until I got things to work. And the important thing is to test is actually the day of Labor Day and the day after Labor Day. And if it works for those two, it almost certainly works, but I tried a couple other values as well. So that let's call it trial and error. It was a little more clever than that, but really not
probably
much.
Similar to the number of days.
It is related, yeah, it is on the scale of 365, part of the reason for that, yeah.
The number of days before 9. So 9 months is 275
days. 275 almost certainly comes from the day of the year that is Labor Day. It's roughly the 275th day of the year. So what's happening here is we take the month and we multiply it by 30, because there's basically 30 days in a month. We take the day and we just add it, negate it. and then we shift that sum by 275, so that if it's less than 275, that means it's early in the year, and if it's greater than 275, it's or flipped than that. But yeah, so it actually did come from someplace. John is right. All right, so what's in mathematical notation, we can write the same thing. So if we have, if I is one of the input features, x sub I is the input on that feature, w sub I is the weight coming out of that corresponding unit, y is the output of the network, and so the output, according to this, is going to be the sum over all the features of what the value is on that feature times the weight that I picked, and then that's all added together, and if it's greater than 0, then y is 1, otherwise it's 0. And this is what that same thing looks like in Python. So it's not hard to do that classification once you know this weight vector w. All the smarts of this classifier are encoded in those weights. All right, before I tell you how to find these weights, let me give you some other examples of some cool things that people have done with these kinds of networks. This is a car driving neural network that was at Carnegie Mellon for a while, where they had a Humvee, an actual, military Humvee, with a camera mounted, I think this is the camera, I think it was mounted inside the cab at the top of the window looking out at the road. And it was just digitizing the image that it got off the road and turning it into a grayscale picture of the road. Those were all input units. Each pixel of that picture was an input unit that had weights to go to a hidden unit, that had weights to go to which way the wheel should turn. And the way they train this is they'd have a person drive the truck up a road, and what the machine would learn to do is basically spot the road and whether it was drifting off the road or not and make driving adjustments. But it was just trying to mimic the way that it thought a person would handle that same situation. When I was a first-year graduate student at CMU, I got into the Humvee along with the other first-year CS graduate students. They just put us in the back, and then they drove the truck up a road, and then they turned it around, and then they walked away from the wheel and let it drive us down. There's a certain amount of, it's almost like that exercise where you close your eyes and fall backwards and you hope that the computer catches you. It was a lot like that. It worked, though. It was pretty neat.
They have the great race in, like, Nevada for that.
The Grand Challenge?
Yeah.
Yeah, which is pretty amazing. Now, the winner of that race, who also came out of CMU but then moved to Stanford, the system was much more sophisticated than this in so many different ways. It was amazing. It used some learning, but not at this level. It actually used learning to do things like to learn when to accelerate and when to decelerate so that it gets a smooth ride. And they did that by copying this Sebastian Thrun, the German guy who was the head of the team. He would just drive, and then they took all the settings. He actually came and gave a talk at Rutgers last year about this, just after he had won. They took the settings that the computer learned from watching him drive and then toned it down a little bit because he was sort of an aggressive driver. But you're right, that's right. This has actually advanced quite a bit since that original application. Here's another one that people have looked at, which is will a person default on a loan application trying to judge whether or not a person's a good risk? And the inputs here are basically the age of the person and the person's income, and the prediction is whether or not they're going to default. And so some banks actually use, or at least had used, something like this for a while. There's a system that reads about half the printed checks, bank checks in the US, that's also based on a learning neural network that does some pretty neat stuff. It takes handwritten, the digits, when you write the value of the check, how much money you're checking away to somebody else, extracts a bunch of features based on that, puts it through a neural network with lots and lots of input units, and then the output is it a 0, a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, like that. And learns to recognize the actual digit sequence that people have handwritten, which is pretty neat. There's better handwriting. Well, I don't know. This was pretty state-of-the-art in terms of handwriting recognition. There's better systems for recognizing typed digits or typed printing, because that's an easier problem. A lot of speech recognition work has been done with neural networks, but all of them use learning in some way or another. In fact, if you've ever had a voice recognition system that you've used, there's always this training phase where you have to give it a bunch of labeled examples, because it trains the weights in some kind of, either a neural net or something a lot like it. It takes the speech signal, does a spectral analysis on it to find what the different tones are, looks at different windows of this at one time, puts it through a neural net, and the neural net outputs a score for each possible phoneme. Was that a or an ah or a s? And then there's a post-processing that goes on that tries to weave those phonemes together to figure out what word was actually spoken. Like,
but there, right in the middle of it, is the little neural net that was trained up from data. I mentioned TV Gammon in the clicker questions. This actually had a neural net in it that would evaluate backgammon boards. It would basically say, all right, if here's where all the pieces are on the board, am I likely to win this game, or am I likely to lose this game? And because it can make those judgments, each time it's turned to move, it simulates each of the places it might move to, and then asks the neural net, is this a good place to move to, or is this not a good place to move to? Whichever one is the best, it does that move, and the game continues. And it plays a darn good game of backgammon. World-class game of backgammon. All right, so how do we actually get these weights to be set properly so that we can do all these cool things, these cool neural netty things? All right, it's hinted at in the book, but if you really care about any of the details, there's some decent Wikipedia pages on the Delta rule and perceptron training rule. Two very similar rules, but slightly different. All right, let's see, how much do I want to get into this? So I mentioned already that, let's say that we start off with some guess at the weights. It's probably wrong, but it's just a guess at the weights. We can take all the examples in the input and put them through the neural net and find out what label it would put with the current weight settings. Let's say that T is what it should put. Right? Y is what it actually outputs for a given example. T is what it should have done. If Y equals T, it got the right answer. If Y does not equal T, then it got the wrong answer. So here's what we're going to do. We're actually going to change the weight of each of the input weights a little bit. This alpha is some number between 0 and 1. A little bit in the direction of T minus Y, the difference between what it should have done and what it did do. If that difference is 0, nothing needs to change. But if that difference is positive or negative, it actually ends up changing the weight. So here's, we could stare at the math for a while, but it's easier to kind of think about it this way. Let's say that it output a 0, and it should have output a 0, then T minus Y is 0, they're the same number, and that's the right answer, nothing changes. On the other hand, if it should have output a 0, but it actually output a 1, then T minus Y is negative 1, and that means the output, whatever the output was, it was too big. And therefore, the weights need to be decreased on the units that had a positive input and decreased on and increased on the ones that had a negative input so that the value won't be so big anymore. So that's exactly what happens. This weight gets updated as whatever the input is times whatever that difference is, and so it ends up making the output smaller for that example next time around. On the other hand, if it output a 0 but it should have output a 1, then T minus Y is 1, the output is too small, so it actually increases the weights on the positive units so that it'll give a bigger answer next time. It just makes them all the weights just a little bit bigger. It still might not be right, but it's going to keep iterating this until the weights get into the right range. If, on the other hand, it output a 1 and it was supposed to output a 1, T minus Y is 0, the weights don't change, everything's cool. So you just keep repeating this rule over and over again on different examples, and the weights change, and they change, and they change, and they'll keep changing until they find a place where they don't have to change anymore. So here's a little Python implementation of this. I think I'm not going to run this for you right now. You could type this into your own version of Python and see what it does. But suffice it to say that really what's happening here is it just keeps changing. You use this perceptron rule that changes the weights repeatedly. As long as the weights are changing, it keeps doing this update rule until eventually the weights stop changing. When the weights stop changing, it outputs that as the answer. And here's what we know about this. The weights will stop changing whenever the system stops making mistakes. If there's a way of setting the weights that makes no mistakes, it will be, this is an interesting theorem actually, it will find the right answer if there is one. It may take a long time, but it's just going to keep changing those weights until it locks into something that works. On the other hand, it might be that the problem is not solvable this way. There's no set of weights that gives you perfect answers. In which case, the weights are just going to keep bouncing around. So it's kind of a neat approach. In fact, in the 50s, people got very, very excited about this, that this was going to basically solve all problems because of this property.
that it just keeps searching until it finds the right answer. And if there is a right answer, it will find it.
Then it turns out, let's see. Well, I'll get to this in a second. There are some examples where the right ways don't exist, even some very simple ones. And when Marvin Minsky and Seymour Papert, I think his name was, at MIT, as it turns out, explained to everybody where this goes wrong, nobody wanted to touch them again for another 20 or 30 years. And then new ideas came up and people got excited again and there was another wave. But these two guys managed to kill this idea for a very long time. So this is what they discovered in a nutshell. So here's this is the example of Labor Day, just shown graphically. All right. So I took, for example, each date that was in the training set. I put it up there as either a plus or a zero. So for example, one of them was 8:30, my birthday. August 30th was a positive example. And so what I did on this graph is I have month 8. Day 30, I put a little plus there, meaning this is a positive example. I think another one was March something, and that's this example. Then there was December 25th, I think that's this example, that was a negative example. You're not supposed to wear the white shoes. So each of the examples you can put as a little dot in a picture. Now the number of dimensions here is 2, right? There's because there was 2 inputs, a month and the day. On the other hand, you could imagine an example with hundreds of inputs that would be very hard to draw. But conceptually, each example is a point in a high-dimensional space. And so what the perceptron learning rule does is it tries to find a dividing line between the positive examples and the negative examples. And the slope of that line corresponds to the weights that it learns. And in this particular example, the wear away after Labor Day example, it finds a line that very tightly slices between these 2 days in September that matter, and puts all the pluses on one side, all the zeros on the other. So this example turns out to work. The perceptron can find this line. It does it pretty quickly, too. Here's another example. You can think of OR as being another thing that you might want to train on. What does OR say? If one input is a 1 and the other input is a 0, then the output should be positive. If they're both 1s, it should be positive. If it's 0, 1, it should be positive. But if they're both 0s, it should be negative. Well, does this one have a dividing line that separates the positives from the negatives? Who thinks yes? Who thinks no? Seriously, I got no hands from the whole class in that. Help me out here. Is there a way that I could put a slice through this picture so that all the pluses are on one side and all the O's are on the other? Okay. Who thinks no, you can't do that? There's no way of putting a slice through so that you separate the ones and the zeros. Okay, so got a no and another no. All right. Who thinks that you can? If there's a line that you could put through this picture so that the positives are on one side and the zeros are on the other. Okay, thanks. And now I can actually separate the hands from the not hands. No, I can't do that because there's a person in the middle there. All right, so in this case, yeah, of course you can, right? You can just slice off this corner. You can put a nice straight line so that all the positives are on this side and all the zeros are on that side. Okay? This is called, the training set is linearly separable. A line can separate the positive from the negative examples. But we can really easily make up examples where you can't do that. So this is a training set which is trying to learn the concept of Virgo. People know, like, Virgo is a zodiac sign, right? And it's anybody who was born between August something and September something are a Virgo. For particular values of something that I don't know, 23 or something like that. And so if you actually plot them on a graph like this, what you find is it starts off that people aren't Virgos, and then somehow in the two-thirds of the way through the year, then people are Virgos, and then become not Virgos again. There's no way to put a line through this picture to separate the positives from the negatives. Right? You can lop this guy off. Well, you can't even lop this guy off. You can lop this guy off, but then this guy's on the wrong side of the line. You end up needing two lines, right? You need one line to separate the beginning of the year zeros, and one line to separate out the end of the year zeros, and it's only the stuff in the middle that end up being the positive examples. Virgo is not linearly separable. Perceptron will die on this example. And by die, I just mean it doesn't actually get anywhere, just the numbers keep changing and changing. A simpler example that has the same property is XOR. We've talked about XOR a couple times. XOR, the output is 1 if one of the inputs is 1 and the other one's 0, or 1, 0, or 0, 1 are okay, but 0, 0, and 1, 1 are not. And you get a picture that looks a lot like the Virgo picture.
You can slice off the 0-0 case, and you can slice off the 1-1 case, but you can't put them on the same side of the line. Or if you do, then you'll end up capturing one of the pluses on the same side of the line. There's no way to separate the zeros from the ones with a single line. This is not linearly separable. So basically, Minsky and Papert got up and they said, XOR! And everybody said, oh, crap! And they went home and they started working on something else. All right, there's lots of things that people have done since then. There's an algorithm that was invented called backpropagation that actually can solve XOR by using more than one layer of weights. It doesn't always work, but it works a lot, and it's very powerful, and it can solve all sorts of cute and interesting problems. All the examples that I gave you before, they were all trained up with some variation of backprop. Some people have looked at recurrent networks where after the outputs get spit out, they come back and are used as inputs the next time through, and they can get kind of wacky. And now there's lots of statistically grounded algorithms that actually have some nice theory behind them. We understand when they work and when they don't work. There's a lot, how much training they need to solve a problem of a given level of difficulty. So it's gotten very sophisticated since the early beginnings. All right, so here's what I would like to do now. Sondheim, I want to tell you a little bit about decision trees. So let me give you, I'm going to give you one concrete example, and then I'm going to need your help coming up with a test problem that we can run on the class. But let me start off with this. So I said that, so this is a decision tree. How do you read a decision tree? So decision tree is a tree, kind of graph, a directed graph. And the way that we interpret it, it's a classifier. It's a classifier that takes as input a feature vector and outputs either 0 or 1, yes or no. So here's what this one does. It takes in as input a month and a day. We start off at the root, and we answer this question. Is the month that you just gave me less than 8 before August? If the answer is yes, then the output is no, it's done. But if the answer is no to this question, then there's more questions to ask. The next thing it does, it says, well, okay, the month is not less than 8. Is it equal to 8? If the answer is yes, then it asks, is the day less than 23? If the answer to that is yes, then this decision tree, this classifier, will output no. If the day is bigger than 23, then it outputs yes. All right, on the other hand, if the month is not equal to 8, and not less than 8, okay, it must be greater than 8. So the next question is, well, is it equal to 9? If the answer is no, then this outputs no. But if the answer is yes, it's equal to 9, then it tests, is the day less than 24? If the answer is yes, it says yes. If the answer is no, it says no. And now, no matter what values we put through here, it's going to end up at some leaf, it's going to get some class, yes or no, and it'll be done. So what is this answering yes for? Right? Can you figure out what concept this this classifier is actually representing?
Virgo.
Virgo? Then who said Virgo? You? Yeah. So assuming that Virgo, oh, maybe it's even been on the previous slide, was it? No, I brought up a web page. I didn't put it in the lecture notes. So Virgo is anything from August 23rd to September 23rd. No, sorry, yeah, September 23rd. That's Virgo. And so this is actually going to say yes if the date is a Virgo date, and no if the date is not a Virgo date. So you were exactly right. So this is the Virgo thing. Now, you can't represent it with a perceptron, but you can represent it with a decision tree. It's a slightly hairy decision tree. There's a lot of questions that you have to answer to get down to a yes or no. And maybe you can make it smaller than this, but I don't think so. I think this is pretty much one of the smallest trees you can do. All right. So what I'd like to do is this is a classifier. What a learning algorithm needs to do is take a bunch of examples and then from that produce a tree like this that does as well as possible at classifying new instances, new examples. So what I want to step through with you is, at least informally, is how we could build a tree like this given examples. Okay. All right. You with me? Now this is the part I need help with. What I'd like to do is have each of us in the room be an instance in this network, or sorry, in this or the training set. And so what I'd like to do is have each of us answer a series of questions, which are going to be the things, in this case it's like the month and the day and so forth, but some other questions about us. We're going to record them with the clicker. We're going to create a big table which lists for each person as a row in that table, what answer did they give to each of the questions that we're going to use. And then there's going to be a last bit, which is that we all have to click in, which will be what the answer is for us. We have to decide what the question is trying to learn. And then we'll step through the process of actually building a tree that will try to classify us. And we can see whether it does the right thing for how many people it does the right thing for. Now, if we had maybe twice the number of people, what we could do is split the class into the training set and the test set. The training set would mean half of us would be used, our clicks would be used to actually build the decision tree, and then we would test it on the other half of the class to see whether or not it does a good job of generalizing. But there's not very many of us, and it depends on how hard a concept we end up using as to whether or not that will actually work. So, I don't know, in my head I kept trying to think through what sort of features we could use, and I kept thinking that people weren't going to go for it. Like hair color, probably you're okay with that, if I had everybody click in their hair color. But like weight, probably some of you would be less good with that. So what's something that we could try to predict? A yes, no thing that we could try to predict. Also like, you know, grade on the midterm. I didn't want to use that as a feature.
Age?
Sure, we could do age. So that would be something we could click in for everybody. But what are we trying to predict? We're trying to build a classifier that can take a person and will guess something about them. What's that? We could guess, okay, so gender, sex, let's say, like male, female, that would be good. That would be, that's okay with me, but if people are uncomfortable with that, please tell me before we go too deep into this example. So the suggestion, and I think this is a reasonable suggestion, is we're going to have people answer a series of questions, and then based on the answers, the decision tree is going to try to guess whether you're a boy or a girl.
What about height?
So height would be predictive of sex, possibly. At least I can imagine it might be. Right, so in particular, on average, boys are taller than girls, but there's going to be flips in that, right? There's probably at least one female in the class who's taller than at least one male in the class. So probably we'll need some other features to train on as well.
Voice pitch.
Voice pitch. That would probably be pretty telling, though I don't know what you could click in on. Like, do you have a no voice? I mean, it's sort of not exactly testable. You know, do you like NASCAR? I mean, do you ever watch Oxygen? I mean, there's all sorts of questions that wouldn't be in and of themselves completely discriminating, but maybe in a full picture would actually give you information. Does that seem not okay? Or does you're okay with that?
Yeah.
So what would be, so like, did you go to the football game? That's probably not a very discriminating question.
Blood type.
We could ask blood type, though I think that really just isn't going to tell us anything about sex.
So how many people know their blood type?
Does anybody not know their own blood type? Okay, so we might not want to use that. Well, maybe actually, do you know your blood type?
We just got the answer.
Well, we're gonna tell the computer. I don't know, own a computer, own a car, own a shotgun, I don't know. Own a curling iron. own a curling iron?
How about a hair dryer?
Hair dryer, okay. All right, so I'm going to say that this is probably enough for now. We'll see if this works out. This is, remember, you know, we're on the tightrope now. This could go any which way, but I think at least we'll learn something about this process. All right, so let's do this. We're going to click in. I know two people have clickers that are loners. Let me make sure I have your clicker number and your name. All right, so this is my list of clicker numbers. You now can see everybody else's clicker numbers. If you've got a loner, raise your hand. So, okay, so remind me of your name. Oh, yeah. And, oh, you're up here already. Because you have a normal clicker, but we're giving you a second clicker. All right, what's the clicker that you've got today?
0063F99A.
All right, and there was another one? Yeah. Right.
And the number is
0057B582. H2? Yes. Like that. All right. If anybody else can see, your clicker number, make sure it's right. I think we've been getting clicks from everybody, so we're probably all right. All right. So, what do we need to do next? Now we need to actually ask the clicker questions. So, So age. Now we've only got, you can only choose from five choices, right? So there may be more than five ages here. So we might want to have ranges. Like, how young are people? Anybody 15 or below? Anybody 14, or sorry, we're gonna go the other way. 16, 17, 18? All right, so we'll have A. A is 18, B is 19, C is 20, D is 21, and E is more. Okay? All right, so let's click that in. I don't have to hide my answer from you. You can probably guess where I am. What's that? Everybody knows my answer. It's not secret. Oh, you don't want to give my answer. You get full credit if you give my answer, but that's not what you want. Click for yourself. Click your own age in, please. All right? If you didn't do that, do it now. Is everybody good? That's no, because we don't have all 20 clicks in. This is not meant to be a hard question, folks. Why do we only have 15 clicks? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17. I'm thinking we should have a couple more clicks.
Oh, you know what? Mine was off the whole time.
Okay, we're up to 17. I'm happier. Just do yours again. Just make sure it's powered on and click it in. It won't count. It won't add one to the count if you've already been through.
Yeah.
All right. So that's question one. Stop. This is one. All right. Sex. Now this is in particular. Yeah. A male, B female.
For question two. We can look at this now. That's fun. Look at that nice bell curve we have. All right. So now this is starting on number question two, which is please click A if you are male and B if you are female. No cheating and checking the answer of the person next to you. All right.
Stopping in 3, 2, 1. Stop.
We have somewhat more men than women, but not as skewed as you'll see in most computer science classes, just so you know.
I'm glad about that. All right, so height. All right. We've got five levels. We probably have people ranging from maybe like 5 foot to 7 foot. That should include everybody, I think. Anybody under 5 feet? All right, so 5 feet, so how do we break that into levels? So like 5 to 5.5, 5.5 to 6. No, that's too short. 6.5, yeah, everybody's gonna be in the same bucket. So let's try it by quarters.
I don't know mine by quarters.
What range, do you know which range you,
okay,
oh, 5 1/4 feet. So we'll do it in inches. That's 5'3".
Okay.
Right? So this is 5'3" to 5'6. That's 5.5 feet. Yeah. Then 5'6" to 5'9". Then 5'9" to 6 feet. Then 6 feet to 6.
Plus.
Yeah, and above. All right, so that's A, B, C, D, D.
Any questions before we start clicking in? Good, all right. I still think somehow I'll get over 6 feet before I die.
It was my dream.
All right, stopping. 3, 2, 1. Good. You're definitely getting better at this.
It's cracked up.
Being over 6 feet, really? All right, do you know your blood type? A equals yes, B equals no.
Buckers pluses are uncomfortable.
if you're too tall. Height is interesting. Interesting.
You see, it's sort of bimodal, right? We have a spike at the A and a spike at the D. Could that be boys and girls?
I don't know. Could it be mistakes? Could be.
All right, so this is blood type now. Click in your blood type. A, if you know it, and B, if you don't.
Do I know it?
Yeah.
Very good, very good. All right, 3, 2, 1. I think that's everybody. Nice, split.
Excellent. The questions where we're split are the most useful and interesting. All right, do you own a hairdryer, have a hairdryer, have access to a hairdryer? How should we word this?
Do you use
a hairdryer? Use hairdryer. And again, A is yes, and B is no.
Question 5, start your clickers.
I definitely do not anymore. Can you imagine? I get this big fuzzy ball on my head, or fuzzier. Okay.
All right, we're up to 17. 3, 2, 1, if you want to change your answer, we are stopped. All right, excellent, all right. Let's see if we can make this thing work. In 3 minutes, no! No! All right, Python. Okay. Read data, how many questions we have? 5. All right, so that should be everybody. Can you see your name? If anybody can see that their name is not up there, please say something now, because then you're going to be out of the game. Oh, we have a couple people who are in, but we don't have any clicks.
Say
that.
Abby.
I thought I saw her.
She left.
That would make sense, right? Because she knew she was here, but she didn't answer anything.
Duh! All right, so she's a girl. Whose name? Cassandra's name's not there. Interesting. But John is.
I certainly didn't click. Maybe she has a borrowed clicker.
Oh, is EAHC? Is that you?
No.
No. Really? You're 582. Huh. Interesting. Interesting. All right, anyway, okay. So let's I don't know how far we're going to be able to get with this. But let me give it a try. So here's the first step. We need to decide which node is going to be the root of our tree. So which node is going to go to the top? So here's what I did. I took all possible nodes that could be at the top, and I checked to see which ones do the best job of splitting boys from girls. So attribute, well, this is actually now 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, the way Python counts. So the first thing we do is we split on age, and one person, or some people click nothing, and that doesn't really help anything. So age C, yes, no, age and C splits the boys from the girls 3/4 by, oh wait, sorry, which one is the sex? It's number 1, all right. Let's try this again. All right, so, interesting. So most of the, what's this saying? This says, if you put the first node at the top of the tree as being, check whether or not the age is 20. If the age is 20, if the answer is yes, here's what I'm going to do. Now that I've got the data and that we're out of time, I'm going to play with this a little bit, make sure find a nicer way of displaying it, and I'll lead off on Wednesday with a little exploration of this. And then we'll do the last chapter. We'll start on the last chapter of the book, which is on genetic algorithms, evolution.
What you can do is have the book here today.
Okay. They can be the testing data.
Then we have to go through this process of clicking in again. And Cassandra, I'll find out where your clicks went. Sandra?
Okay. All right.
Interesting.